Sergei Ivanovich and Katavasov had just reached the station of the Kursk line, which was particularly busy and full of people that day. When looking around for the groom who was following with their things, they saw a party of volunteers driving up in four cabs. Ladies met them with bouquets of flowers, and followed by the rushing crowd, they went into the station. One of the ladies who had met the volunteers came out of the hall and addressed Sergei Ivanovich. "You also come to see them off?" she asked in French. "No, I'm going away myself, princess, to my brother's for a holiday." "Do you always see them off?" said Sergei Ivanovich with a barely perceptible smile. "Oh, that would be impossible," answered the princess. "Is it true that 800 have been sent from us already? Malvinsky wouldn't believe me." "More than 800. If you reckon those who have been sent not directly from Moscow, over 1,000, answered Sergei Ivanovich. "There, that's just what I said," exclaimed the lady joyously. "And it's true, too, I suppose, that about 1,000,000 has been subscribed." "Yes, princess." "What do you say to today's telegram? The Turks have been overwhelmed again." "Yes, so I saw," answered Sergei Ivanovich. They were speaking of the last telegram stating that the Turks had been for 3 days in succession beaten at all points and put to flight, and that tomorrow a decisive engagement was expected. "Ah, by the way, a splendid young fellow has asked leave to go, and they've made some difficulty. I don't know why. I meant to ask you. I know him. Please, write a note about his case. He's being sent by Countess Lydia Ivanovna." Sergei Ivanovich asked for all the details the princess knew about the young man, and going into the first-class waiting room, wrote a note to the person on whom the granting of leave of absence depended, and handed it to the princess. "Do you know Count Vronsky, the notorious one, is going by this train?" said the princess with a smile full of triumph and meaning when he found her again and gave her the letter. "I had heard he was going, but I did not know when. By this train? I've seen him. He's here. There's only his mother seeing him off. It's the best thing, anyway, that he could do." "Oh, yes, of course." While they were talking, the crowd streamed by them toward the dining table. They went forward, too, and heard a gentleman with a glass in his hand delivering a loud discourse to the volunteers. "In the service of religion, humanity, and our brethren," the gentleman said, his voice growing louder and louder, "to this great cause, Mother Moscow dedicates you with her blessing. Zhivyo," he concluded, loudly and cheerfully. Everyone shouted Zhivyo, and a fresh crowd dashed into the hall, almost carrying the princess off her feet. "Ah, princess, that was something like," said Stepan Arkadyevich, suddenly appearing in the midst of the crowd and beaming upon them with a delighted smile. "Capitally, warmly said, wasn't it? Bravo. And Sergei Ivanovich? Why, you ought to have said something, just a few words, you know, to encourage them. You do that so well," he added with a soft, respectful, and discreet smile, moving Sergei Ivanovich forward a little by the arm. "No, I'm just off. Where to?" "To the country, to my brother's," answered Sergei Ivanovich. "Then you'll see my wife. I've written to her, but you'll see her first. Please tell her that they've seen me and that it's all right," said the, as the English say. "She'll understand." "Oh, and be so good as to tell her I'm appointed member of the committee, but she'll understand. You know, les petites miseries, de la vie humaine," he said, as it were apologizing to the princess. "And Princess Myakaya, not Lisa, but Bibish, is sending 1,000 guns and 12 nurses after all. Did I tell you?" "Yes, I heard so," answered Koznishev indifferently. "It's a pity you're going away," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "Tomorrow we're giving a dinner to two who are setting off, Dimmer Vietnyansky from Peterburg and our Veslovsky, Risha. They're both going. Veslovsky's only lately married. There's a fine fellow for you, eh, princess?" he turned to the lady. The princess looked at Koznishev without replying, but the fact that Sergei Ivanovich and the princess seemed anxious to get rid of him did not in the least disconcert Stepan Arkadyevich. Smiling, he stared at the feather in the princess's hat, and then about him as though he were going to pick something up. Seeing a lady approaching with a collection box, he beckoned her up and put in a 5-ruble note. "I can never see these collection boxes unmoved while I've money in my pocket," he said. "And how about today's telegram? Fine chaps, those Montenegrins. You don't say so, he cried when the princess told him that Vronsky was going by this train. For an instant, Stepan Arkadyevich's face looked sad, but a minute later, when stroking his whiskers and swinging as he walked, he went into the hall where Vronsky was. He had completely forgotten his own despairing sobs over his sister's corpse, and he saw in Vronsky only a hero and an old friend. With all his faults, one can't refuse to do him justice, said the princess to Sergei Ivanovich, as soon as Stepan Arkadyevich had left them. What a typically Russian, Slav nature. Only I'm afraid it won't be pleasant for Vronsky to see him. Say what you will, I'm touched by that man's fate. Do talk to him a little on the way, said the princess. Yes, perhaps, if the occasion arises. I never liked him, but this atones for a great deal. He's not merely going himself, he's taking a squadron at his own expense. Yes, so I heard. A bell sounded. Everyone crowded to the doors. Here he is, said the princess, indicating Vronsky, who, with his mother on his arm, walked by, wearing a long overcoat and wide-brimmed black hat. Oblonsky was walking beside him, talking eagerly of something. Vronsky was frowning and looking straight before him, as though he did not hear what Stepan Arkadyevich was saying. Probably, on Oblonsky's pointing them out, he looked round in the direction where the princess and Sergei Ivanovich were standing, and without speaking lifted his hat. His face, aged and worn by suffering, looked stony. Going on to the platform, Vronsky left his mother and disappeared into a compartment. On the platform there rang out, God save the Tsar, then shouts of Hurrah and Jivio. One of the volunteers, a tall, very young man with a hollow chest, was particularly conspicuous, bowing and waving his felt hat and a nosegay over his head. Then two officers emerged, bowing too, and a stout man with a big beard wearing a greasy forage cap. Chapter 3. Having said goodbye to the princess, Sergei Ivanovich was joined by Katavasov. Together they got into a carriage full to overflowing, and the train started. At Zarastino station, the train was met by a chorus of young men singing Hail to Thee. Again the volunteers bowed and poked their heads out, but Sergei Ivanovich paid no attention to them. He had had so much to do with the volunteers that the type was familiar to him and did not interest him. Katavasov, whose scientific work had prevented his having a chance of observing them hitherto, was very much interested in them and questioned Sergei Ivanovich. Sergei Ivanovich advised him to go into the second class and talk to them himself. At the next station, Katavasov acted on this suggestion. At the first stop, he moved into the second class and made the acquaintance of the volunteers. They were sitting in a corner of the carriage, talking loudly and obviously aware that the attention of the passengers, and of Katavasov as he got in, was concentrated upon them. More loudly than all talked the tall, hollow-chested young man. He was unmistakably tipsy and was relating some story that had occurred at his school. Facing him sat a middle-aged officer in the Austrian military jacket of the guard's uniform. He was listening with a smile to the hollow-chested youth, and occasionally pulling him up. The third, in an artillery uniform, was sitting on a portmanteau beside them. A fourth was asleep. Entering into conversation with the youth, Katavasov learned that he was a wealthy Moscow merchant who had run through a large fortune before he was 22. Katavasov did not like him, because he was unmanly and effeminate and sickly. He was obviously convinced, especially now after drinking, that he was performing a heroic action, and he bragged of it in the most unpleasant way. The second, the retired officer, made an unpleasant impression, too, upon Katavasov. He was, it seemed, the man who had tried everything. He had been on a railway, had been a land steward, and had started factories, and he talked quite without necessity of everything, and used learned expressions quite inappropriately. The third, the artilleryman, on the contrary, struck Katavasov very favorably. He was a quiet, modest fellow, unmistakably impressed by the knowledge of the officer and the heroic self-sacrifice of the merchant, and saying nothing about himself. When Katavasov asked him what had impelled him to go to Serbia, he answered modestly, "Oh, well, everyone's going. The Servians want help, too. I'm sorry for them. Yes, you artillerymen are especially scarce there, said Katavasov. Oh, I wasn't long in the artillery. Maybe they'll put me into the infantry or the cavalry. Into the infantry, when they need artillery more than anything, said Katavasov, fancying from the artilleryman's apparent age that he must have reached a fairly high grade. I wasn't long in the artillery. I'm a junker in reserve, he said, and he began to explain how he had failed his examination. All of this together made a disagreeable impression on Katavasov, and when the volunteers got out at a station for a drink, Katavasov would have liked to compare his unfavorable impression in conversation with someone. There was an old man in the carriage wearing a military overcoat who had been listening all the while to Katavasov's conversation with the volunteers. When they were left alone, Katavasov addressed him. What different positions they come from. All those fellows who are going off there, Katavasov said vaguely, not wishing to express his own opinion, and at the same time anxious to find out the old man's views. The old man was an officer who had served in two campaigns. He knew what makes a soldier, and judging by the appearance and the talk of those persons, by the swagger with which they had recourse to the bottle on the journey, he considered them poor soldiers. Moreover, he lived in a district town, and he was longing to tell how one soldier had volunteered from his town, a drunkard and a thief whom no one would employ as a laborer. But knowing by experience that in the present condition of the public temper it was dangerous to express an opinion opposed to the general one, and especially to criticize the volunteers unfavorably, he too watched Katavasov without committing himself. Well, men are wanted there, he said, laughing with his eyes, and they fell to talking of the last war news, and each concealed from the other his perplexity as to the engagement expected next day, since the Turks had been beaten, according to the latest news, all along the line. And so they parted, neither giving expression to his opinion. Katavasov went back to his own carriage, and with reluctant hypocrisy reported to Sergei Ivanovich his observations of the volunteers, from which it would appear that they were capital fellows. At a big station at a town, the volunteers were again greeted with shouts and singing. Again men and women with collection boxes appeared, and provincial ladies brought bouquets to the volunteers and followed them into the refreshment room. But all this was on a much smaller and feebler scale than in Moscow. Chapter 4. While a train was stopping at the provincial town, Sergei Ivanovich did not go to the refreshment room, but walked up and down the platform. The first time he passed Vronsky's compartment, he noticed that the curtain was drawn over the window. But as he passed it the second time, he saw the old countess at the window. She beckoned to Koznishev. I'm going, you see, taking him as far as Kursk, she said. Yes, so I heard, said Sergei Ivanovich, standing at her window and peeping in. What a noble act on his part, he added, noticing that Vronsky was not in the compartment. Yes, after his misfortune, what was there for him to do? What a terrible thing it was, said Sergei Ivanovich. Ah, what I have been through. But do get in. And what I have been through, she repeated, when Sergei Ivanovich had got in and sat down beside her. You can't conceive it. For 6 weeks he did not speak to anyone and would not touch food except when I implored him. And not for 1 minute could we leave him alone. We took away everything he could have used against himself. We lived on the ground floor, but there was no reckoning on anything. You know, of course, that he had shot himself once already on her account, she said, and the old lady's brows contracted at the recollection. Yes, hers was the fitting end for such a woman. Even the death she chose was low and vulgar. It's not for us to judge, Countess, said Sergei Ivanovich, sighing, but I can understand that it has been very hard for you. Ah, don't speak of it. I was staying on my estate, and he was with me. A note was brought him. He wrote an answer and sent it off. We hadn't any idea that she was close by at the station. In the evening, I had only just gone to my room when my Mary told me a lady had thrown herself under the train. Something seemed to strike me at once. I knew it was she. The first thing I said was that he was not to be told, but they told him already. His coachman was there and saw it all. When I ran into his room, he was beside himself. It was frightful to see him. He didn't say a word, but galloped off there. I don't know to this day what happened there, but he was brought back at death's door. I shouldn't have known him. Prostration complete, the doctor said, and that was followed almost by madness. Oh, why talk of it, said the Countess with a wave of her hand. It was an awful time. No, say what you will, she was a bad woman. Why? What is the meaning of such desperate passions? It was all to show herself something out of the ordinary. Well, and that she did do. She brought herself to ruin, and two good men, her husband and my unhappy son. And what did her husband do? Asked Sergei Ivanovich. He has taken her daughter. Alyosha was ready to agree to anything at first. Now it worries him terribly that he should have given his own child away to another man, but he can't take back his word. Karenin came to the funeral, but we tried to prevent his meeting Alyosha. For him, for her husband, it was easier anyway. She had set him free. But my poor son was utterly given up to her. He had thrown up everything, his career, me, and even then she had no mercy on him. But of set purpose, she made his ruin complete. No, say what you will, her very death was the death of a vile woman, of no religious feeling. God forgive me, but I can't help hating the memory of her when I look at my son's misery. But how is he now? It was a blessing from Providence for us, this Servian war. I'm old, and I don't understand the rights and wrongs of it, but it's come as a providential blessing to him. Of course, for me, as his mother, it's terrible, and what's worse, they say, Sine pa tre bien bua, Peterborg, but it can't be helped. It was the one thing that could rouse him. Ayashvin, a friend of his, he had lost all he had at cards, and he was going to Serbia. He came to see him and persuaded him to go. Now it's an interest for him. Do please talk to him a little. I want to distract his mind. He's so low-spirited. And as bad luck would have it, he has a toothache, too. But he'll be delighted to see you. Please do talk to him. He's walking up and down on that side. Sergei Ivanovich said he would be glad to and crossed over to the other side of the station. Chapter 5. In the slanting evening shadows cast by the baggage piled up on the platform, Vronsky in his long overcoat and slouch hat, with his hands in his pockets, strode up and down, like a wild beast in a cage, sharply turning every 20 paces. Sergei Ivanovich fancied as he approached him that Vronsky saw him but was pretending not to see. This did not affect Sergei Ivanovich in the slightest. He was above all personal considerations with Vronsky. At that moment, Sergei Ivanovich looked upon Vronsky as a man taking an important part in a great cause, and Koznishev thought it his duty to encourage him and express his approval. He went up to him. Vronsky stood still, looked intently at him, recognized him, and going a few steps forward to meet him, shook hands with him very warmly. Possibly you didn't wish to see me, said Sergei Ivanovich, but couldn't I be of use to you? There's no one I should less dislike seeing than you, said Vronsky. Forgive me. There's nothing in life for me to like. I quite understand, and I merely meant to offer you my services, said Sergei Ivanovich, scanning Vronsky's face, full of unmistakable suffering. Wouldn't it be of use to you to have a letter to Ristich, to Milan? Oh, no, Vronsky said, seeming to understand him with difficulty. If you don't mind, let's walk on. It's so stuffy among the cars. A letter? No, thank you. To meet death, one needs no letters of introduction. The Turks take, he said with a smile that was merely of the lips. His eyes still kept their look of angry suffering. Yes, but you might find it easier to get into relations, which are, after all, essential, with anyone prepared to see you. But that's as you like. I was very glad to hear of your intention. There have been so many attacks made on the volunteers, and a man like you raises them in public estimation. My use as a man, said Vronsky, is that life's worth nothing to me, and that I've enough bodily energy to cut my way into their ranks and to trample on them or fall. I know that. I'm glad there's something to give my life for it's not simply useless but loathsome to me. Anyone's welcome to it. And his jaw twitched impatiently, from the incessant nagging toothache that prevented him from even speaking with a natural expression. "You will become another man, I predict," said Sergei Ivanovich, feeling touched. "To deliver one's brethren from bondage is an aim worth death and life. God grant you success outwardly and inwardly peace," he added, and he held out his hand. Vronsky warmly squeezed his outstretched hand. "Yes, as a weapon I may be of some use, but as a man I'm a wreck," he jerked out. He could hardly speak for the throbbing ache in his strong tooth, his mouth being filled up with saliva. He was silent, and his eyes rested on the wheels of the tender, slowly and smoothly rolling along the rails. And all at once a different pain, not an ache, but an inner trouble, that set his whole being in anguish, made him for an instant forget his toothache. As he glanced at the tender and the rails, under the influence of the conversation with the friend he had not met since his misfortune, he suddenly recalled her, that is, what was left of her, when he had run like one distraught into the barrack of the railway station. On the table, shamelessly sprawling out among strangers, the blood-stained body so lately full of life, the head, unhurt, dropping back with its weight of hair, and the curling tresses about the temples, and the exquisite face with red, half-open mouth, the strange, fixed expression, piteous on the lips, and awful in the still open eyes, that seemed to utter that fearful phrase, that he would be sorry for it, which she had said when they were quarreling. And he tried to think of her as she was when he met her the first time, at a railway station too, mysterious, exquisite, loving, seeking and giving happiness, and not cruelly revengeful as he remembered her at that last moment. He tried to recall his best moments with her, but those moments were poisoned forever. He could only think of her as triumphant, successful in her menace of a wholly useless remorse, never to be effaced. He lost all consciousness of toothache, and his face worked with sobs. Passing twice up and down beside the baggage in silence and regaining his self-possession, he addressed Sergei Ivanovich calmly. "You have had no telegram since yesterday's?" "Yes, driven back for a third time, but a decisive engagement expected for tomorrow." And after talking a little more of the proclaiming of Milan as king and the immense effect this might have, they parted, going to their cars on hearing the second bell. Chapter 6. Sergei Ivanovich had not telegraphed to his brother to send to meet him, as he did not know when he should be able to leave Moscow. Levin was not at home when Katavasov and Sergei Ivanovich, in a wagonette hired at the station, drove up to the steps of the Pokrovskoe house, as black as negroes from the dust of the road. Kitty, sitting on the balcony with her father and sister, recognized her brother-in-law and ran down to meet him. "What a shame not to have let us know," she said, giving her hand to Sergei Ivanovich and putting her forehead up for him to kiss. "We drove here capitally and have not put you out," answered Sergei Ivanovich. "I'm so dirty, I'm afraid to touch you. I've been so busy, I didn't know when I should be able to tear myself away." "And so you're still as ever enjoying your peaceful, quiet happiness," he said, smiling, "out of the reach of the current in your peaceful backwater. Here's our friend Fyodor Vasilievich, successful in getting here at last." "But I'm not a Negro. I shall look like a human being when I wash," said Katavasov, in his jesting fashion. And he shook hands and smiled, his teeth flashing white in his black face. "Kostya will be delighted. He has gone to his grange. It's time he should be home." "Busy as ever with his farming. It really is a peaceful backwater," said Katavasov, "while we in town think of nothing but the Servian War. Well, how does our friend look at it? He's sure not to think like other people." "Oh, I don't know. He's like everybody else," Kitty answered, a little embarrassed, looking round at Sergei Ivanovich. "I'll send to fetch him. Papa's staying with us. He's only just come home from abroad." And making arrangements to send for Levin and for the guests to wash, one in his room and the other in what had been Dolly's, and giving orders for their luncheon, Kitty ran out on the balcony, enjoying the freedom and rapidity of movement of which she had been deprived during the months of her pregnancy. "It's Sergei Ivanovich and Katavasov, a professor," she said. "Oh, it's hard in such a heat," said the prince. No, Papa, he's very nice, and Kostya is very fond of him, Kitty said with a deprecating smile, noticing the irony on her father's face. Oh, I didn't say anything. You go to them, darling, said Kitty to her sister, and entertain them. They saw Stiva at the station. He was quite well. And I must run to Mattia. As ill luck would have it, I haven't fed him since tea. He's awake now and sure to be screaming. And feeling a rush of milk, she hurried to the nursery. This was not a mere guess. Her connection with the child was still so close. She could gauge by the flow of her milk his need of food, and knew for certain he was hungry. She knew he was crying before she reached the nursery, and he was indeed crying. She heard him and hastened, but the faster she went, the louder he screamed. It was a fine, healthy scream, hungry and impatient. Has he been screaming long, nurse? Very long, said Kitty, hurriedly seating herself on a chair and preparing to give the baby the breast. But give me him quickly. Oh, nurse, how tiresome you are. There, tie the cap afterward, do. The baby's greedy scream was passing into sobs. But you can't manage so, ma'am, said Agatha Mikhailovna, who was almost always to be found in the nursery. He must be put straight. Ooh, ooh, she chanted over him, paying no attention to the mother. The nurse brought the baby to his mother. Agatha Mikhailovna followed him with a face melting with tenderness. He knows me, he knows me. In God's faith, Katerina Alexandrovna, ma'am, he recognized me. Agatha Mikhailovna cried above the baby's screams. But Kitty did not hear her words. Her impatience kept growing like the baby's. This impatience hindered things for a while. The baby could not get hold of the breast right and was furious. At last, after despairing, breathless screaming, and vain sucking, things went right, and mother and child felt simultaneously soothed, and both subsided into calm. But poor darling, he's all in perspiration, said Kitty in a whisper, touching the baby. What makes you think he knows you, she added, with a sidelong glance at the baby's eyes that peered roguishly, as she fancied, from under his cap, at his rhythmically puffing cheeks and the little red-palmed hand he was waving. Impossible. If he knew anyone, he would have known me, said Kitty, in response to Agatha Mikhailovna's statement, and she smiled. She smiled because, though she said he could not know her, in her heart she was sure that he knew not merely Agatha Mikhailovna, but that he knew and understood everything, and knew and understood a great deal, too, that no one else knew, and that she, his mother, had learned and come to understand only through him. To Agatha Mikhailovna, to the nurse, to his grandfather, to his father even, Mattia was a living being, requiring only material care. But for his mother, he had long been a moral being with whom there had been a whole series of spiritual relations already. When he wakes up, please God, you shall see for yourself. Then when I do like this, he simply beams on me, the darling. Simply beams like a sunny day, said Agatha Mikhailovna. Well, well, then we shall see, whispered Kitty. But now go away. He's going to sleep. Chapter 7 Agatha Mikhailovna went out on tiptoe. The nurse let down the blind, chased flies out from under the muslin canopy of the crib, and a hornet struggling on the window frame, and sat down waving a faded branch of birch over the mother and the baby. How hot it is. If God would send a drop of rain, she said. Yes, yes, shh, was all Kitty answered, rocking a little and tenderly squeezing the plump little arm with rolls of fat at the wrist, which Mattia still waved feebly as he opened and shut his eyes. That hand worried Kitty. She longed to kiss the little hand, but was afraid to, for fear of waking the baby. At last the little hand ceased waving and the eyes closed. Only from time to time, as he went on sucking, the baby raised his long curly eyelashes and peeped at his mother with humid eyes that looked black in the twilight. The nurse had left off fanning and was dozing. From above came the peals of the old prince's voice and the chuckle of Katavasov. They have got into talk without me, thought Kitty, but still it's vexing that Kostya is out. He's sure to have gone to the bee house again. Though it's a pity he's there so often, still I'm glad it distracts his mind. He's become altogether happier and better now than in the spring. He used to be so gloomy and worried that I felt frightened for him. And how absurd he is, she whispered, smiling. She knew what worried her husband. It was his unbelief. although if she had been asked whether she supposed that in the future life, if he did not believe, he would be damned, she would have had to admit that he would be damned. His unbelief did not cause her unhappiness. And she confessing that for an unbeliever there can be no salvation, and loving her husband's soul more than anything in that world, thought with a smile of her unbelief, and told herself that he was absurd. What does he keep reading philosophy of some sort for all this year, she wondered. If it's all written in those books, he can understand them. If it's all wrong, why does he read them? He says himself that he would like to believe. Then why is it he doesn't believe? Surely, from his thinking so much? And he thinks so much from being solitary. He's always alone, alone. He can't talk about it all to us. I fancy he'll be glad of these visitors, especially Katavasov. He likes discussions with them, she thought, and passed instantly to the consideration of where it would be more convenient to put Katavasov, to sleep alone, or to share Sergei Ivanovich's room. And then an idea suddenly struck her which made her shudder and even disturb Mattia, who glanced severely at her. I do believe the laundress Hansen sent the washing yet, and all the guest sheets are in use. If I don't see to it, Agatha Mikhailova will give Sergei Ivanovich the used sheets. And at the very idea of this, the blood rushed to Kitty's face. Yes, I will arrange it, she decided, and going back to her former thoughts, she remembered that some spiritual question of importance had been interrupted, and she began to recall what. Yes, Kostya, an unbeliever, she thought again with a smile. Well, an unbeliever, then, better let him always be one than like Madame Stahl, or what I tried to be in those days abroad. No, he won't ever sham anything. And a recent instance of his goodness rose vividly to her mind. A fortnight ago, a penitent letter had come from Stepan Arkadyevich to Dolly. He besought her to save his honor, to sell her estate to pay his debts. Dolly was in despair. She detested her husband, despised him, pitied him, resolved on a separation, resolved to refuse, but ended by agreeing to sell part of her property. After that, with an irrepressible smile of tenderness, Kitty recalled her husband's shamefaced embarrassment, his repeated awkward efforts to approach the subject, and how at last, having thought of the one means of helping Dolly without wounding her pride, he had suggested to Kitty, what had not occurred to her before, that she should give up her share of the property. He, an unbeliever indeed, with his heart, his dread of offending anyone, even a child. Everything for others, nothing for himself. Sergei Ivanovich simply considers it as Kostya's duty to be his bailiff. And it's the same with his sister. Now Dolly and her children are under his guardianship. All these peasants have come to him every day, as though he were bound to be at their service. Yes, only be like your father, only like him, she said, handing Mitya over to the nurse and putting her lips to his cheek. Chapter 8. Ever since, by his beloved brother's deathbed, Levin had first glanced into the questions of life and death in the light of these new convictions, as he called them, which had, during the period from his 20th to his 34th year, imperceptibly replaced his childish and youthful beliefs. He had been stricken with horror not so much of death as of life, without any knowledge of whence and why and how and what it was. The physical organization, its decay, the instructability of matter, the law of the conservation of energy, evolution, were the words which usurped the place of his old belief. These words and the ideas associated with them were very well for intellectual purposes. But for life they yielded nothing, and Levin felt suddenly like a man who had changed his warm fur cloak for a muslin garment, and going for the first time into the frost is immediately convinced, not by reason, but by his whole nature, that he is as good as naked, and that he must infallibly perish miserably. From that moment, though he did not distinctly face it, and still went on living as before, Levin had never lost this sense of terror at his lack of knowledge. He vaguely felt, too, that what he called his new convictions were not merely lack of knowledge, but that they were part of a whole order of ideas in which no knowledge of what he needed was possible. At first, marriage, with the new joys and duties bound up with it, had completely crowded out these thoughts. But of late, while he was staying in Moscow after his wife's confinement, with nothing to do, the question that clamored for solution had more and more often, more and more insistently haunted Levin's mind. The question was summed up for him thus: if I do not accept the answers Christianity gives to the problems of my life, what answers do I accept? And in the whole arsenal of his convictions, so far from finding any satisfactory answers, he was utterly unable to find anything at all like an answer. He was in the position of a man seeking food in toy shops and firearm shops. Instinctively, unconsciously, with every book, with every conversation, with every man he met, he was on the lookout for light on these questions and their solution. What puzzled and distracted him above everything was that the majority of men of his age and circle had, like him, exchanged their old beliefs for the same new convictions, and yet saw nothing to lament in this, and were perfectly satisfied and serene, so that, apart from the principal question, Levin was tortured by other questions too. Were these people sincere, or were they playing a part? Or was it that they understood the answers science gave to these problems in some different, clearer sense than he did? And he assiduously studied both these men's opinions and the books which treated of these scientific explanations. One fact he had found out since these questions had engrossed his mind, that he had been quite wrong in supposing, from the recollections of the university circle of his young days, that religion had outlived its day, and that it was now practically non-existent. All the people nearest to him who were good in their lives were believers. The old prince and Lvov, whom he liked so much, and Sergei Ivanovich, and all the women believed, and his wife believed as simply as he had believed in his earliest childhood. And 99 hundredths of the Russian people, all the people for whose life he felt the deepest respect, believed. Another fact of which he became convinced, after reading many books, was that the men who shared his views had no other construction to put on them, and that they gave no explanation of the questions which he felt he could not live without answering, but simply ignored their existence and attempted to explain other questions of no possible interest to him, such as the evolution of organisms, the mechanistic theory of the soul, etc. Moreover, during his wife's confinement, something had happened that seemed extraordinary to him. He, an unbeliever, had fallen into praying, and at the moment he prayed, he believed. But that moment had passed, and he could not make his state of mind at that moment fit into the rest of his life. He could not admit that at that moment he knew the truth, and that now he was wrong. For as soon as he began thinking calmly about it, it all fell to pieces. He could not admit that he was mistaken then, for his spiritual condition then was precious to him, and to admit that it was a proof of weakness would have been to desecrate those moments. He was miserably divided against himself and strained all his spiritual forces to the utmost to escape from this condition. Chapter 9. These doubts fretted and harassed him, growing weaker or stronger from time to time, but never leaving him. He read and thought, and the more he read and the more he thought, the further he felt from the aim he was pursuing. Of late in Moscow and in the country, since he had become convinced that he would find no solution to the materialists, he had read and reread thoroughly Plato, Spinoza, Kant, Schelling, Hegel, and Schopenhauer, those philosophers who gave a non-materialistic explanation of life. Their ideas seemed to him fruitful when he was reading or was himself seeking arguments to refute other theories, especially those of the materialists. But as soon as he began to read or sought for himself a solution of problems, the same thing always happened. As long as he followed the fixed definition of vague words such as spirit, will, freedom, substance, purposely letting himself go into the snare of words the philosophers or he himself set for him, he seemed to comprehend something. But he had only to forget the artificial train of reasoning and to turn from life itself to what had satisfied him while thinking in accordance with the fixed definitions, and all this artificial edifice fell to pieces at once, like a house of cards, and it became clear that the edifice had been built up out of those transposed words, apart from a something in life that was more important than reason. At one time, reading Schopenhauer, he put in place of his will the word love, and for a couple of days this new philosophy consoled him, till he removed away from it. But then, when he turned from life itself to glance at it again, it fell away too, and proved to be the same muslin garment with no warmth in it. His brother, Sergei Ivanovich, advised him to read the theological works of Komiakoff. Levin read the second volume of Komiakoff's works, and in spite of the elegant, epigrammatic, polemic style, which at first repelled him, he was impressed by the doctrine of the church he found in them. He was struck at first by the idea that the apprehension of divine truths had not been vouchsafed to man, but to a corporation of men bound together by love, the church. What delighted him was the thought how much easier it was to believe in a still-existing living church, embracing all the beliefs of men and having God at its head, and therefore holy and infallible, and from it to accept the faith in God, in the creation, the fall, the redemption, than to begin with God, a mysterious, faraway God, the creation, etc. But afterward, on reading a Catholic writer's history of the Church, and then a Greek Orthodox writer's history of the Church, and seeing that the two churches, in their very conception infallible, each deny the authority of the other, Komiakoff's doctrine of the Church lost all its charm for him, and this edifice crumbled into dust like the philosopher's edifices. All that spring he was not himself and went through fearful moments of horror. Without knowing what I am and why I am here, life's impossible, and that I can't know, and so I can't live, Levin said to himself. In infinite time, in infinite matter, in infinite space, is formed a bubble organism, and that bubble lasts a while and bursts, and that bubble is me. It was an agonizing error, but it was the sole logical result of ages of human thought in that direction. This was the ultimate belief on which all the systems elaborated by human thought, in almost all their ramifications, rested. It was the prevalent conviction, and of all other explanations, Levin had unconsciously, not knowing when or how, chosen it, as the clearest at any rate, and made it his own. But it was not merely a falsehood. It was the cruel jeer of some wicked power, some evil, hateful power, to whom one could not submit. He must escape from this power, and the means of escape every man had in his own hands. He had but to cut short this dependence on evil, and there was one means, death. And Levin, a happy father and a man in perfect health, was several times so near suicide that he hid the cord, lest he be tempted to hang himself, and was afraid to go out with his gun for fear of shooting himself. But Levin did not shoot himself and did not hang himself. He went on living. Chapter 10. When Levin thought what he was and what he was living for, he could find no answer to the questions and was reduced to despair. But when he left off questioning himself about it, it seemed as though he knew both what he was and what he was living for, acting and living resolutely and without hesitation. Even in these latter days, he was far more decided and unhesitating in life than he had ever been. When he went back to the country at the beginning of June, he went back also to his usual pursuits, his agriculture, his relations with the peasants and the neighbors, the care of his household, the management of his sister's and brother's property, of which he had the direction, his relations with his wife and kindred, the care of his child, and the new beekeeping hobby he had taken up that spring filled all his time. These things occupied him now, not because he justified them to himself by any sort of general principles, as he had done in former days. On the contrary, disappointed by the failure of his former efforts for the general welfare, and too much occupied with his own thought and the mass of business with which he was burdened from all sides, he had completely given up thinking of the general good, and he busied himself with all this work simply because it seemed to him that he must do what he was doing, that he could not do otherwise. In former days, almost from childhood and increasingly up to full manhood, when he had tried to do anything that would be good for all, for humanity, for Russia, for the whole village, he had noticed that the idea of it had been pleasant, but the work itself had always been incoherent, that then he had never had a full conviction of its absolute necessity, and that the work that had begun by seeming so great had grown less and less till it vanished into nothing. But now, since his marriage, when he had begun to confine himself more and more to living for himself, though he experienced no delight at all at the thought of the work he was doing, he felt a complete conviction of its necessity, saw that it succeeded far better than in old days, and that it kept on growing more and more. Now, involuntarily, it seemed, he cut more and more deeply into the soil like a plow, so that he could not be drawn out without turning aside the furrow. To live the same family life as his father and forefathers, that is, in the same condition of culture, and to bring up his children in the same, was incontestably necessary. It was as necessary as dining when one was hungry, and to do this, just as it was necessary to cook dinner, it was necessary to keep the mechanism of agriculture at Pokrovsko going so as to yield an income. Just as incontestably as it was necessary to repay a debt, was it necessary to keep the patrimonial estate in such a condition that his son, when he received it as a heritage, would say, "Thank you," to his father, as Levin had said, "Thank you," to the grandfather for all he had built and planted. And to do this, it was necessary to look after the land himself, not to let it, and to breed cattle, manure the fields, and plant timber. It was impossible not to look after the affairs of Sergei Ivanovich, of his sister, of all the peasants who came to him for advice and were accustomed to do so, as impossible as to fling down a child one is carrying in one's arms. It was necessary to look after the comfort of his sister-in-law and her children, and of his wife and baby, and it was impossible not to spend with them at least a short time each day. And all this, together with shooting and his new beekeeping, filled up the whole of Levin's life, which had no meaning at all for him, when he began to think. But besides knowing thoroughly what he had to do, Levin knew in just the same way how he had to do it all, and what was of more importance than the rest. He knew he must hire laborers as cheaply as possible, but to hire men under bond, paying them in advance at less than the current rate of wages, was what he must not do, even though it was very profitable. Selling straw to the peasants in times of scarcity of provender was what he might do, even though he felt sorry for them. But the tavern and the pothouse must be put down, though they were a source of income. Felling timber must be punished as severely as possible, but he could not exact forfeits for cattle being driven into his fields. And though it annoyed the keeper and made the peasants not afraid to graze their cattle on his land, he could not keep their cattle as a punishment. To Peter, who was paying a money lender 10% a month, he must lend a sum of money to set him free, but he could not let off peasants who did not pay their rent, nor let them fall into arrears. It was impossible to overlook the bailiffs not having mown the meadows and letting the hay spoil, and it was equally impossible to mow 80 desiatinas where a young copse had been planted. It was impossible to excuse a laborer who had gone home in the busy season because his father was dying, however sorry he might feel for him, and he must subtract from his pay those costly months of idleness, but it was impossible not to allow monthly rations to the old servants who were of absolutely no use. Levin knew also that when he got home he must first of all go to his wife, who was unwell, and that the peasants who had been waiting for 3 hours to see him could wait a little longer. He knew, too, that, regardless of all the pleasure he felt in taking a swarm, he must forego that pleasure and leave the old man to see to the bees alone, while he talked to the peasants who had come after him to the bee house. Whether he were acting rightly or wrongly, he did not know. And far from trying to prove which it was nowadays, he avoided all thought or talk about it. Reasoning had brought him to doubt and prevented him from seeing what he ought to do and what he ought not. When he did not think but simply lived, he was continually aware of the presence of an infallible judge in his soul, determining which of two possible courses of action was the better and which was the worse. And as soon as he did not act rightly, he was at once aware of it. So he lived, not knowing and not seeing any chance of knowing what he was and what he was living for, and harassed at this lack of knowledge to such a point that he was afraid of suicide, and yet firmly laying down his own individual definite path in life. Chapter 11. The day on which Sergei Ivanovich came to Pokrovskoe was one of Levin's most painful days. It was the very busiest working time when all the peasantry show an extraordinary intensity of self-sacrifice and labor, such as is not to be found in any other conditions of life, and would be highly esteemed if the men who showed these qualities themselves thought highly of them. And if it were not repeated every year, and if the results of this intense labor were not so simple. To reap and bind and cart off the rye and oats, to mow the meadows, turn over the fallows, thresh the seed, and sow the winter corn. All this seems so simple and ordinary, but to succeed in getting through it all, everyone in the village, from the old man to the young child, must toil incessantly for 3 or 4 weeks, 3 times as hard as usual, living on kvass, onions, and black bread, threshing and carrying the sheaves at night, and not giving more than 2 or 3 hours in the 24 to sleep. And every year, this is done all over Russia. Having lived the greater part of his life in the country and in the closest relations with the peasants, Levin always felt in this busy time that he was infected by this general quickening of energy in the people. In the early morning, he rode over to the first sowing of the rye and to the oats, which were being carried to the stacks, and returning home at the time his wife and sister-in-law were getting up. He drank coffee with them and walked to the grange, where a new threshing machine was to be set working to get ready the seed. All this day Levin, while talking with the bailiff and the peasants, and at home with his wife and Dolly and her children, and his father-in-law, kept on thinking of one thing and one thing only, that which at this time engrossed him most outside of the cares of his estate, and in everything he sought a relation to his questioning. What am I, then? And where am I? And why am I here? He was standing in the cool threshing barn, still fragrant with the leaves of the hazel branches interlaced on the freshly peeled aspen beams of the new thatch roof. He gazed through the open door in which the dry, bitter chaff dust swirled and played, at the grass of the threshing floor in the sunlight and the fresh straw that had been brought in from the barn. Then at the speckly-headed, white-breasted swallows that flew chirping in under the roof and, fluttering their wings, settled in the crevices of the doorway. Then at the peasants bustling in the dark, dusty barn, and he thought strange thoughts. Why is all this being done? He thought. Why am I standing here making them work? What are they all so busy for, trying to show their zeal before me? For what reason is old Matryona, my old friend, toiling? I doctored her when the beam fell on her in the fire, he thought, looking at a thin old woman who was raking up the grain, moving painfully with her bare, sun-blackened feet over the uneven, rough floor. Then she recovered, but today or tomorrow or in 10 years she won't. They'll bury her, and nothing will be left either of her or of that dashing woman in the red skirt, who with that skillful, gentle action is shaking the ears out of their husks. They'll bury her, as well as this piebald gelding, and very soon, too, he thought, gazing at the heavily moving, panting horse that kept walking up the treadwheel that turned under him. And they will bury her, and Fyodor the thresher with his curly beard full of chafe, and his shirt torn on his white shoulders. They will bury him. He's untying the sheaves, and giving orders, and shouting to the women, and quickly setting straight the strap on the moving wheel. And what's more, it's not them alone they'll bury me too, and nothing will be left. What for? He thought this and at the same time looked at his watch to reckon how much they threshed in an hour. He wanted to know this so as to judge by it the task set for the day. It'll soon be one, and they're only beginning the third sheaf, thought Levin. He went up to the man who was feeding the machine, and shouting over the roar of the machine, he told him to feed it more slowly. You put in too much at a time, Fyodor. Do you see? It gets choked. That's why it isn't getting on. Do it evenly. Fyodor, black with the dust that clung to his moist face, shouted something in response, but still went on doing as Levin did not want him to. Levin, going up to the machine, moved Fyodor aside and began feeding the machine himself. Working on till the peasant's dinner hour, which was not long in coming, he went out of the barn with Fyodor and fell in to talk with him, stopping beside a neat yellow sheaf of rye laid on the threshing floor for seed. Fyodor came from a village at some distance from the one in which Levin had once allotted his land to his cooperative association. Now it had been let to the innkeeper. Levin talked to Fyodor about this land and asked whether Platon, a well-to-do peasant of good character belonging to the same village, would not take the land for the coming year. It's a high rent. It wouldn't pay Platon, Konstantin Dmitrich, answered the peasant, picking the ears off his sweat-drenched shirt. But how does Kirillov make it pay? Matuka, so the peasant called the innkeeper in a tone of contempt. You may be sure he'll make it pay, Konstantin Dmitrich. He'll get his share, however he has to squeeze to get it. He's no mercy on a peasant. But Uncle Openich, so he called the old peasant Platon, do you suppose he flay the skin off a man? Where there's debt, he'll let anyone off, and he'll suffer losses. He's human, too. But why will he let anyone off? Oh, well, of course, folks are different. One man lives for his own wants and nothing else, like Matuka, thinking only of filling his belly. But Fokinich is a righteous old man. He lives for his soul. He does not forget God. How does he think of God? How does he live for his soul? Levin almost shouted. Why, to be sure, in truth, in God's way. Folks are different. Take you now. You wouldn't wrong a man. Yes, yes. Goodbye, said Levin, breathless with excitement, and turning round, he took his stick and walked quickly away toward home. At the peasant's words that Fokinich lived for his soul, in truth, in God's way, undefined but significant ideas seemed to burst forth. As though they had been locked up, and all of them striving toward one goal, they thronged whirling through his head, blinding him with their light. Chapter 12 Levin strode along the high road, absorbed not so much in his thoughts, he could not yet disentangle them, as in his spiritual condition, unlike anything he had experienced before. The words uttered by the peasant had acted on his soul like an electric shock, suddenly transforming and combining into a single whole the whole swarm of disjointed, impotent, separate thoughts that incessantly occupied his mind. These thoughts had unconsciously been in his mind even when he was talking about the land. He was aware of something new in his soul and joyfully tested this new thing, not yet knowing what it was. Not living for his own wants, but for God. For what God? And could one say anything more senseless than what he said? He said that one must not live for one's own wants, that is, that one must not live for what we understand, what we are attracted by, what we desire, but must live for something incomprehensible, for God, whom no one can understand nor even define. What of it? Didn't I understand those senseless words of Fyodor's? And understanding them, did I doubt their truth? Did I think them stupid, obscure, inexact? No, I understood him, and exactly as he understands the words. I understood them more fully and clearly than I understand anything in life, and never in my life have I doubted, nor can I doubt about them. And not only I, but everyone, the whole world, understands nothing fully but this, and about this only they have no doubt, and are always agreed. Fyodor says that Kirillov, the innkeeper, lives for his belly. That's comprehensible and rational. All of us as rational beings can't do anything else but live for our belly. And all of a sudden, the same Fyodor says that one mustn't live for one's belly, but must live for truth, for God. And at a hint, I understand him. And I and millions of men, men who lived ages ago and men living now, peasants, the poor in spirit and the sages, who have thought and written about it in their obscure words, saying the same thing. We are all agreed about this one thing, what we must live for and what is good. I and all men have only one firm, incontestable, clear knowledge, and that knowledge cannot be explained by reason. It is outside it and has no causes and can have no effects. If goodness has causes, it is not goodness. If it has effects, a reward, it is not goodness either. So goodness is outside the chain of cause and effect. And yet I know it, and we all know it. And I sought miracles, complained that I did not see a miracle which would convince me. And here is a miracle, the sole miracle possible, continually existing, surrounding me on all sides, and I never noticed it. What could be a greater miracle than that? Can I have found the solution of it all? Can my sufferings be over? Thought Levin, striding along the dusty road, not noticing the heat nor his weariness, and experiencing a sense of relief from prolonged suffering. This feeling was so delicious that it seemed to him incredible. He was breathless with emotion and incapable of going farther. He turned off the road into the forest and lay down in the shade of an aspen on the uncut grass. He took his hat off his hot head and lay propped on his elbow in the lush, feathery woodland grass. Yes, I must make it clear to myself and understand, he thought, looking intently at the untrampled grass before him, and following the movements of a green beetle, advancing along a blade of couch grass, and lifting up in its progress a leaf of goatweed. Everything from beginning, he asked himself, bending aside the leaf of goatweed, out of the beetle's way, and twisting another blade of grass above for the beetle to cross over to. What is it makes me glad? What have I discovered? Of old I used to say that in my body, that in the body of this grass and of this beetle, there she didn't care for the grass, she opened her wings and flew away. And there was going on a transformation of matter in accordance with physical, chemical, and physiological laws. And in all of us, as well as in the aspens and clouds and nebulae, there was a process of evolution. Evolution from what? Into what? Eternal evolution and struggle? As though there could be any sort of tendency and struggle in the eternal. And I was astonished that in spite of utmost effort of thought in this direction, I could not discover the meaning of life, the meaning of my impulses and yearnings. And the meaning of my impulses is so clear within me that I was living according to them all the time, and I was astonished and rejoiced when the peasant expressed it to me, to live for God, for my soul. I have discovered nothing. I have only found out what I knew. I understand the force that in the past gave me life, and now too gives me life. I have been set free from falsity. I have found the Master. And he briefly went through, mentally, the whole course of his ideas during the last 2 years, the beginning of which was the clear confronting of death at the sight of his dear brother, hopelessly ill. Then, for the first time, grasping that for every man, and himself too, there was nothing in store but suffering, death, and eternal oblivion, he had made up his mind that life was impossible like that, and that he must either interpret life so that it would not present itself to him as the evil jest of some devil, or else shoot himself. But he had not done either, but had gone on living, thinking, and feeling, and had even at that very time married, and had had many joys, and had been happy when he was not thinking of the meaning of his life. What did this mean? It meant that he had been living rightly, but thinking wrongly. He had lived, without being aware of it, on those spiritual truths that he had sucked in with his mother's milk, but he had thought, not merely without recognition of these truths, but studiously ignoring them. Now it was clear to him that he could live only by virtue of the beliefs in which he had been brought up. What should I have been, and how should I have spent my life if I had not had these beliefs, if I had not known that I must live for God and not for my own wants? I should have robbed and lied and killed. Nothing of what makes the chief happiness of my life would have existed for me. And with the utmost stretch of imagination, he could not conceive the brutal creature he would have been himself if he had not known what he was living for. I looked for an answer to my question, and thought could not give an answer to my question. It is incommensurable with my question. The answer has been given me by life itself, in my knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. And that knowledge I did not arrive at in any way. It was given to me as to all men, given because I could not have got it from anywhere. Where could I have got it? Could I have arrived through reason at knowing that I must love my neighbor and not oppress him? I was told that in my childhood, and I believed it gladly, for they told me what was already in my soul. But who discovered it? Not reason. Reason discovered the struggle for existence and the law that requires us to oppress all who hinder the satisfaction of our desires. That is the deduction of reason. But loving one's neighbor, reason could never discover, because that is unreasonable. Yes, pride, he said to himself, turning over on his abdomen and beginning to tie a noose of blades of grass, trying not to break them. And not merely pride of intellect, but dullness of intellect. And most of all, its knavishness. Yes, the knavishness of intellect. The cheating knavishness of intellect. That's it, he repeated. Chapter 13. And Levin remembered a scene he had lately witnessed between Dolly and her children. The children, left to themselves, had begun cooking raspberries over the candles and squirting milk into each other's mouths with the syringe. Their mother, catching them at these pranks, began reminding them, in Levin's presence, of the trouble their mischief gave to the grown-up people, and that this trouble was all for their sake, and that if they smashed the cups, they would have nothing to drink their tea out of, and that if they wasted the milk, they would have nothing to eat and die of hunger. And Levin had been struck by the passive, weary incredulity with which the children heard what their mother said to them. They were simply annoyed that their amusing play had been interrupted, and did not believe a word of what their mother was saying. They could not believe it indeed, for they could not take in the immensity of all they habitually enjoyed, and so could not conceive that what they were destroying was the very thing they lived by. That all comes of itself, they thought, and there's nothing interesting or important about it, because it has always been so and always will be so. And it's all always the same. We've no need to think about that. It's all ready. But we want to invent something of our own and new. So we thought of putting raspberries in a cup and cooking them over a candle and squirting milk straight into each other's mouths. That's fun and something new and not a bit worse than drinking out of cups. Isn't it just the same that we do, that I did, searching by the aid of reason for the significance of the forces of nature and the meaning of the life of man, he thought. And don't all the theories of philosophy do the same, trying by the path of thought, which is strange and not natural to man, to bring him to a knowledge of what he has known long ago, and knows so certainly that he could not live at all without it? Isn't it distinctly to be seen in the development of each philosopher's theory that he knows what is the chief significance of life beforehand, just as positively as the peasant Fyodor, and not a bit more clearly than he, and is simply trying by a dubious intellectual path to come back to what everyone knows? Now then, leave the children to themselves to get things alone and make their crockery, get the milk from the cows, and so on. Would they be naughty then? Why, they die of hunger. Well, then leave us with our passions and thoughts, without any idea of the one God, of the Creator, or without any idea of what is right, without any idea of moral evil. Just try and build up anything without those ideas. We destroy them only because we're spiritually provided for, exactly like the children. Whence have I that joyful knowledge shared with the peasant, that alone gives peace to my soul? Whence did I get it? Brought up with an idea of God, a Christian, my whole life filled with the spiritual blessings Christianity has given me, full of them, and living on these blessings, like the children, I did not understand them and destroy, that is, try to destroy what I live by. And as soon as an important moment of life comes, like the children when they are cold and hungry, I turn to him, and even less than the children when their mothers scold them for their childish mischief, do I feel that my childish efforts at wanton madness are reckoned against me. Yes, what I know not by reason, but it has been given to me, revealed to me, and I know it with my heart, my faith in the chief thing taught by the church. The church? The church, Levin repeated to himself. He turned over on the other side and, leaning on his elbow, fell to gazing into the distance at a herd of cattle crossing over to the river. But can I believe in all the church teaches, he thought, putting himself to the test and thinking of everything that could destroy his present peace of mind. Intentionally, he recalled all those doctrines of the church, which had always seemed most strange and had always been a stumbling block to him. The creation? But how did I explain existence? By existence? By nothing? The devil and sin? But how do I explain evil? The Redeemer? But I know nothing, nothing, and I can know nothing but what has been told to me and all men. And it seemed to him now that there was not a single article of faith of the church which could destroy the chief thing, faith in God and goodness, as the one goal of man's destiny. Under every article of faith of the church could be put the faith in the service of truth instead of one's wants. And each doctrine did not simply leave that faith unshaken. Each doctrine seemed essential to complete that great miracle, continually manifest upon earth, that made it possible for each man and millions of different sorts of men, wise men and imbeciles, old men and children, all men, peasants, Lvov, Kitty, beggars and kings, to understand perfectly the same one thing and to build up thereby that life of the soul which alone is worth living and which alone is precious to us. Lying on his back, he gazed up now into the high cloudless sky. Do I not know that this is infinite space and that it is not a round arch? But however I screw up my eyes and strain my sight, I cannot see it as not round and not bounded. And in spite of my knowing about infinite space, I am incontestably right when I see a solid blue dome, and more right than when I strain my eyes to see beyond it. Levin ceased thinking, and only, as it were, listened to mysterious voices that seemed talking joyfully and earnestly with each other. Can this be faith, he thought, afraid to believe in his happiness? My God, I thank thee, he said, gulping down his sobs and with both hands brushing away the tears that filled his eyes. Chapter 14. Levin looked before him and saw a herd of cattle. Then he caught sight of his wagonette with black in the shafts, and the coachman, who, driving up to the herd, said something to the herdsman. Then he heard the rattle of the wheels and the snort of the sleek horse close by him, but he was so buried in his thoughts that he did not even wonder why the coachman had come for him. He only thought of that when the coachman had driven quite up to him and shouted to him, "The mistress sent me. Your brother has come, and some gentleman with him." Levin got into the wagonette and took the reins. As though just roused out of sleep, for a long while Levin could not collect his faculties. He stared at the sleek horse, flecked with lather between his haunches and on his neck, where the harness rubbed, stared at Ivan, the coachman, sitting beside him, and remembered that he was expecting his brother, thought that his wife was most likely uneasy at his long absence, and tried to guess who was the visitor who would come with his brother. And his brother and his wife and the unknown guest seemed to him now quite different from before. He fancied that now his relations with all men would be different. With my brother there will be none of that aloofness there always used to be between us. There will be no disputes. With Kitty there shall never be quarrels. With the visitor, whoever he may be, I will be friendly and amiable. And with the servants, with Ivan, it will all be different. Pulling the stiff rein and holding in the good horse that snorted with impatience and begged to be let go, Levin looked round at Ivan sitting beside him, not knowing what to do with his unoccupied hands, continually pressing down his shirt as it puffed out and he tried to find something to start a conversation about with him. He would have said that Ivan had pulled the saddle girth up too high, but that was like blame, and he longed for friendly, warm talk. Nothing else occurred to him. "Your honor must keep to the right and mind that stump," said the coachman, pulling the rein Levin held. "Please, don't touch anything and don't teach me," said Levin, angered by this interference. Now, as always, interference made him angry, and he felt sorrowfully at once how mistaken had been his supposition that his spiritual condition could immediately change him in contact with reality. He was not a quarter of a verst from home when he saw Grisha and Tanya running to meet him. "Uncle Kostya, Mama's coming, and Grandfather, and Sergey Ivanovich, and someone else," they said, clambering up into the wagonette. "Who is he?" "An awfully terrible person. And he does like this with his arms," said Tanya, getting up in the wagonette and mimicking Katavasov. "Old or young?" asked Levin, laughing, reminded of someone he did not know whom, by Tanya's performance. "Oh, I hope it's not a tiresome person," thought Levin. As soon as he turned at a bend in the road and saw the party coming, Levin recognized Katavasov in a straw hat, walking along swinging his arms just as Tanya had shown him. Katavasov was very fond of discussing metaphysics, having derived his notions from natural science writers who had never studied metaphysics. And in Moscow, Levin had had many arguments with him of late.